are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This begins Disc 2.
Chapter 8, Music. Hazel Foster took voice lessons. She was in the second grade. Somehow, Hazel seemed to know how to look after all of us girls, especially how to help us keep up with our things and teach us things like how to hold a doll like a real baby. She especially seemed to know how to understand tears when anybody got mad. She knew that I loved to sing and spent a lot of time teaching me all the songs that she was learning in voice. One day, she decided to take me to meet Miss Davis, who was the head of the music department. We walked from K Cottage down the long walkway, passing the campus post on our way. I reached out and touched it. "Red light," I said. "You can't stop if you want to go with me," Hazel said. The campus post stood tall all over campus. They looked like tall, octagon-shaped trees with no limbs or branches. In K Cottage, they were home free for hide-and-seek or red light for the 1-2-3 red light game. We got to the end of the sidewalk and crossed the street and finally came to Lineberry Hall, which students simply called the school building. There were large columns in front and 7 steps leading up to the large porch, and then there were 2 double doors, just like in K Cottage, to get in. There were always radiators just inside the double doors that hissed out steam heat and sometimes clanged as though the heat were trying to get in or out. I thought we were going to walk forever before Hazel led me to some stairs. We went down them and walked through hallways. Lots of pianos were playing, coming from everywhere. "Who's playing all those pianos?" I asked. "These are practice rooms," Hazel said. I listened to the pianos on both sides of the long hall, creating a musical path as we walked.
"Practice rooms?"
"Yes, where people go to practice to play good."
"Can I go in there and practice?" I asked.
"No, you don't take piano lessons," she said.
"Can I take piano lessons?"
"Not until you are in the third grade. Now come on, because Miss Davis is waiting on us." I found that Miss Davis's room was large, and Miss Davis's voice filled it all up. Her voice didn't crackle or break like Mrs. Johnson's did, but it was loud, and I was scared of it. Miss Davis stood me beside the huge piano and realized I was not tall enough, so she stood me beside her piano bench. I wanted to hold Hazel's hand, but Hazel stood beside the baby grand. At first, we both sang, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning." Then, Miss Davis asked me to sing it by myself. I opened my mouth. I knew the words, but nothing came out. "You can't be bashful if you're going to sing," she said. So I began singing, timidly at first, then got into the song and figured I had better sing louder or the piano would drown me out. After the song, Miss Davis stood up and hugged me. Her body was big, and her arms enveloped me like a warm coat. I leaned into the hug and felt that I had found a place to hide from all the unkind things in my world. For a while, I went to voice lessons with Hazel, and then I began going 3 times a week by myself. I liked going with somebody else, so I begged Miss Davis to listen to Ann or Billy sing. Finally, she agreed to hear Billy, but she would not let Ann come. "The two of you need to be separated a little. It isn't good for 2 children to be together every single minute." I did not understand this and begged her from time to time, but she never relented. Finally, I settled down with Billy, and another new friendship was born. Billy's eyes were blue, and his hair was blonde. We were drawn to each other like magnets. He was more bashful than I had ever been. His voice would tremble right out of his body and shrink. Miss Davis thought surely he would get over it, but it took him years. When he sang with me, his voice was strong and sweet. Even as a little 7-year-old, I loved to hear him sing. One day, Miss Davis told me that she was taking me off campus to sing for a Lions Club meeting. That frightened me, as I did not want to sing in front of a bunch of lions.
Will they be in cages? I asked. Miss Davis laughed and told me that the Lions Club was a group of men and their wives who did nice things for people. They gave money to different things, and they especially gave money for blind people.
Will they give me money? I asked.
No, she told me, as she tried to explain to me that they gave money to her to give to the music department at the school to buy things that the state wouldn't support.
You will like singing for them, she promised.
Can Billy go? He isn't ready yet, but maybe soon, she said. After about a year, Miss Davis did agree to take Billy on one of our trips. We were going all the way to Greensboro, North Carolina. Billy was going to sing a solo. The room seemed strange and big, but I found comfort in Miss Davis's confident voice as though she did this every day. We practiced for a few minutes, and then people started coming in. The group was always served dinner, and I was not allowed to rake the food off the plate into my mouth.
Look, Billy, I said, this thing on my plate feels like it came from my papa's pasture.
Then I tasted it. Ew, it tastes like it too. Myra, stop that, Miss Davis said, taking the decorative parsley from my hand.
Look, Billy, I persisted, I'm going to put this whole big donut in my mouth at one time.
I began trying to cram the donut in my mouth, not realizing it was really a pastry filled with orange marmalade and a cranberry sauce. Just as I got as much in my mouth as it would hold, Billy reached over and punched my ribs.
Stop that, Miss Davis said as she jumped up with her napkin trying to catch the goo before all of it ran in my lap.
She was too late. A reddish-orange mess ran down my light blue dress as I choked and did not know where to run.
I hate you, I said to Billy, as Miss Davis pulled me up from my chair and marched me off to the bathroom.
I ain't never gonna help you sing again, I shouted at Billy over the heads of the Lions Club members and the other students who doubled over with laughter, and the school principal, who probably wanted to take that little girl over his knee. The stain wouldn't come out. Miss Davis made me turn the dress around, wearing it backward.
Nobody will know the difference, she said.
I will, I said.
Well, maybe you won't do that again, Miss Davis said.
I'm sure she wanted to shake me until my tiny teeth fell out. Then my eyes must have looked so terrified. Miss Davis laughed instead and told me the next time that we would bring an extra dress just in case.
Now you have to help Billy not be afraid of singing, Miss Davis said.
That's what I was doing, I said. Now I don't care if he's scared or not. It was his fault.
I'm sorry, Billy said when I sat back down.
Are you going to help me sing?
Do you know my dress is backward, I said.
It looks better that way, Billy said. It don't neither, and I ain't going to help you sing.
Billy stood up to sing what he was told to sing. Danny Boy, please, he said to me as he passed my chair and patted my head.
Billy's sweet little boy's voice fell over the room like a charm, clear and perfect, but shaking. I felt my heart slip into the song. I didn't understand the song. Its words sounded too sad.
The summer's gone, and all the roses falling.
Yes, the summer was gone, and October was on its way. Last summer, Larry and I had played cowboy and Indian, but sometimes I could get him to play Mommy and Daddy like I had learned at school. Last summer, Daddy and Mama were having a new house of their own built, and I was about to wonder if they had moved into it already, when I noticed Billy was coming to that A of the song. Billy could hit that note with no trouble except when he was in front of lots of people, and it would sometimes get lost inside his fear. Tonight it almost did, but squeaked out timidly, making him more endearing to me. Then he was in that second verse. This verse was even worse to me. It talked about everything dying and even the grave. I knew what graves were. They were those things in the church cemetery that we skipped over in Bible school where dead people were buried. Last year, Dorothy and Hattie had told Ann and me ghost stories about people in graves and haunts and one-armed men. so I could not understand why graves should be in such a pretty tune. Billy was to that part now, and the second A was coming up. His voice shook almost violently as it was about to leave him. My heart went out to him tenderly. "And all my grave will warmer, sweeter be, for you will," he tried to sing. I knew the words go, "For you will bend and tell me that you love me." The A did not come. I waited only for a split second, feeling the song rise up in my chest and wanting to pull Billy's voice with it. "Bend and tell me that you love me," I sang from my chair. Billy's voice joined mine on the word "that," and my voice softened. Most people in the room did not even know it had happened, only those sitting close to me at the table. But Billy knew, and Miss Davis knew. From that moment on, I called Billy Danny Boy most of the time, and from that moment, Tidbit and Danny Boy were school sweethearts. After every program, Miss Davis always gave me some gum. We were not allowed to chew gum in K Cottage, so she made sure it was all gone before taking me into K. Most nights, Miss Davis or one of the high school boys, usually Bobby Churchill, would carry me asleep to the door. This night, I heard a bird singing in the stillness. "To that silly bird," I said, "doesn't he know it's nighttime?" "It's a mockingbird," he told me, "singing for you and Billy." Miss Johnson did not carry me to bed, yet I woke up in the morning every time, not remembering going to bed and wondering what happened to my chewing gum. Chapter 9. The Upper End Rooms. I enjoyed sleeping in the upper end rooms, but I did miss some of the noises my friends made during the nights. The lower end girls in our ward were not allowed to go to the upper end, but we in the upper end were allowed to go down there and play with them. At one end of the hall was Sally Jones' room. Sally was 2 years older than me and was Mrs. Johnson's best helper, doing things like helping us in the clothes closet. We went to the clothes closet every night, all standing in a line outside the door. Mrs. Johnson would take a dress from the hanger and hand it to us for tomorrow. Then we would turn left toward the little lockers where socks and underwear were. Sally would hand those to us, and we would go out again as other girls were coming in. Sally would come into every room at night to be sure all of us were where we were supposed to be, and would check the rooms again every morning to be sure everyone was getting ready for school. I don't remember all the girls in the other rooms, but I do remember ours. Anne, Shelby Jean Hastings, Laverne, and I were in it, and I thought ours was the best room of all. It was full of four little beds with a large post in the middle that held up the ceiling. I named that post Minnie Pearl, and I tried to get Mrs. Johnson to let us glue hats on it. There were two dressers and two baby doll carriages of mine and Anne's in the room. In the two windows in our room, there were spring violets. Mrs. Johnson had taken us to pick the flowers from the ball field behind the gymnasium across the street from our building. Shelby Jean had a snake plant in her pretty holder shaped like a giraffe she brought from her house in Kannapolis. I loved the giraffe's neck, which was also a vase and could hold the violets. Laverne had something even better, a box of Butterfingers. There was never enough candy and a nickel to satisfy mine and Laverne's chocolate appetite. There was a little store in the gym we were allowed to go to twice a week and spend a nickel. It was always a dilemma to decide if we wanted a drink, a candy bar, or chips. Laverne's mother sent her Butterfingers from North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, which made our choice easier to make most days. Sometimes Mrs. Johnson would go down under the building to the basement where the shop was for the maintenance workers. She would buy Cokes for all of us on Saturday night and popcorn. Then we would sit around in the large ward where the smaller girls stayed and listen to the country jukebox on WPTF radio. Those were fun nights, and we loved to try to guess what song was going to be number one. It was one Saturday night, after listening to the radio and then going to bed, that Laverne and I heard something strange in our room. We finally realized it was a mouse. For a little while, we were more afraid that that mouse was going to eat our butterfingers than our toes. As time passed, we became more and more afraid. Shelby Jean and Anne were sound asleep.
"We've got to go tell Miss Johnson," Laverne said.
"Okay, let's count to 10 and then run," I said. We jumped out of bed and met at our room door, grabbed each other, and ran as fast as we could down our branch of the long tunnel hall, afraid that mouse was right behind our heels. Then we froze just as we got to Mrs. Johnson's door. She was snoring like a freight train that had just gone by about 5 minutes ago. Still, we stood there, afraid to go back to our room and afraid to knock. Suddenly, a board creaked in the hallway, and without even wondering what it might be, both of us squealed like pigs and crashed into the room without even knocking. The freight train seemed to jump the track then, as Mrs. Johnson sat up and almost fell out of bed, managing to turn on her lamp at the same time.
"What in the world are you girls doing?"
"A mouse is after us," we blurted out.
"Mice don't eat little girls," she said, through a half-cough and half-yawn.
"But we're scared anyway," I said. Mrs. Johnson produced a mouse trap, and Laverne and I followed her back up the hall to our room and still wondering why those old wooden boards creaked. We snuggled down into our beds until morning. I got up and went to examine what might be in the mouse trap under our dresser, and then chased Laverne with the rodent, trying to get her to touch it. It seemed like furry tales followed us all the way through the years. Chapter 10, The Infirmary. One of the buildings on campus was the infirmary where children went and could stay who ran a fever or got really hurt or sick. Otherwise, they just went there either in the mornings just before school started or at 4:30 in the afternoon, mostly for bumps and bruises. The infirmary was like a little safe house for the big children as well as little ones. You were cared for by a soft-spoken nurse and got to lie in bed and miss school. It was spring when Hazel Foster was instructed to take me to the infirmary because my entire body was broken out with little bumps. I was hoping I had the measles so I could go to bed and drink juice, listen to the radio, and lie around all day. The steps to the infirmary were steep, and the doors were heavy. Hazel pushed open the heavy doors and took me in, and we sat down on the couch.
"Who's in here?" I asked.
"Hey, Myra," Billy said.
"Are you sick?"
Billy was in my class and sat in the chair across from us.
"Hey, Billy," I answered. "No, I itch."
"Who's with you?"
"Nobody, just me," he said.
"Do you itch, too?"
"No, I fell playing ball."
I heard a sound like a toy coming from another chair just to the left of the big infirmary door.
"Who else is here?" I asked.
"Hey, Myra," a young lady said. It was Miss Emmeline Rice, one of the older girls who came down to Kay Cottage sometimes and plays with us when Mrs. Johnson took a night off.
"What you got?" I asked.
"A little pony Cracker Jack clicker," she said. "Do you want to come over here and see it?" Emmeline came over, touched my tiny body, and carried me over to the chair and set me on her lap as she showed me the little pony clicker.
"You can have it," she said.
"Really?" I said as I began clicking the little pony over and over again just as the nurse came out and called me.
"What's wrong with you, Tidbit?" she asked me as she took me by my hand and led me into the little room where all the medicine and lights were.
It smelled funny in there.
"I itch," I said, and clicked the pony and felt Mrs. Butler removing it from my hand.
"Let me see where you itch, and you can have it later," she said.
"Now, what in the world have you done to make you itch?"
"Nothing," I said. "It just did it all by itself. Do I have the measles? Can I go to bed now?"
Mrs. Butler began rubbing lotion on my legs. Her hands felt as soft as my pillow, and I wanted her to never stop rubbing.
"No, you have some kind of a rash," she said. "This lotion should make you feel better." The lotion felt cool and wet, and I thought I would never itch again.
"Can I have a sucker?" I asked.
"Do you want a shot?"
"No, just a sucker."
"Well, only if you promise not to scratch your legs and arms when you go back to school," she said.
"But what if I can't help it?"
"How high can you count?" she asked.
"100,
I said.
"Well, then you count all the way to 100 without scratching."
"What if it still itches?"
"Then you see how many times you can count to 100 without scratching," she said.
"Can I have my pony back?"
"Do you like ponies?" she asked as she handed me the toy and rubbed more lotion on my arms.
"I love 'em," I said, clicking again and again.
"I want a pony to drive all over campus. Just think, I could drive it from my building to the school building and down here and to class, and just like Mary's little lamb and..."
Mrs. Butler interrupted me.
"Myra, you don't drive ponies, you ride them. Besides, you had better stop that, or Miss Benton will take that pony away from you whether you itch or not. Now, here's a sucker. What color do you want?"
"Red,"
I said. "And can Hazel have one?" She handed me another sucker.
"And Billy?"
"Billy can get his own sucker if he needs one," she said.
"How about Ann?"
She took my shoulders and laughed.
"No," she said.
"Keep that clicker quiet, or Miss Benton will surely throw it away." Emmeline laughed as she came into the room.
"You're just a little chatterbox, aren't you?" she said as she patted my head.
"That's what Miss Benton said," I told her. "She said if I did not stop talking in class, she was going to put me in a room by myself so I could just talk to the walls."
Both Mrs. Butler and Emmeline laughed.
I'd rather see her as a happy little chatterbox than the way she looks after having to come back here after a weekend at home, Mrs. Butler said, as Hazel and I pushed open the heavy door of the infirmary.
"Bye, Billy," I said.
"See you back at school."
Chapter 11. More About Food. Anne was from Richlands. Her hair was blonde and her eyes were blue. We sat at the lunch table one Saturday at the noon meal while I was waiting for her to eat her turnip greens.
"I hate them," she said.
"Well, we are not going to get to go to the store if you don't eat them," I said.
"I can't help it," she said. "I really can't eat them."
"Just break them off your plate into your mouth and don't breathe," I said.
"Then hurry up and swallow them down with some milk and you won't even have to taste them."
"I taste them already, and they're not even in my mouth," she said.
She heaved and started to take another bite.
Mrs. Johnson excused all the other girls from the dining room, but Anne and I remained. I was determined she was going to eat those turnip greens because I had promised her if she could not go to the store, I would not go either. When we thought Miss Johnson was not looking, I grabbed Anne's plate and started raking those nasty greens right into my mouth.
"Myra Lee Yarbrough, you stop that!"
roared Mrs. Johnson's large, huffy voice, and I braced myself ready for a spanking as she jerked my chair backwards and pulled me up by my arm. Just then, Anne started throwing up turnip greens all over everything, including Mrs. Johnson. Miss Johnson didn't know whether to hit me or grab a plate for Anne to be sick in. The maids came running from the tables they were cleaning up with napkins in hand.
"Don't touch me!" Mrs. Johnson bellowed to the maids. She let go of my arm to give them a push away from her, and Anne and I ran like bandits all the way down the hall to the front door.
We didn't know what to do then, so we just kept on running outside the door and headed for the bushes under the windows beside our rooms. We heard Mrs. Johnson calling us as she came out the door, too. We stood there holding on to each other for safety, shivering with fear.
"Why'd you do that?" Anne said.
"I was trying to help," I whined. It started out as a whine and then got louder and louder until it turned into a wail.
"Shut up," Anne tried to whisper, but it was too late.
Miss Johnson found our bush and spanked me right there in the outdoors, pulling up my dress and spanking my thighs and bottom until her fury was all gone. Anne stood there already crying.
Miss Johnson was through being mad by then and just told Anne she could go to the store that afternoon because she had tried to eat the turnip greens, but I could not go with her.
Anne started jumping up and down and screaming.
"You're mean," she said to Miss Johnson. "You are a mean old woman. I'm going to tell my mama. You are not supposed to beat on us, Mama said. You're not."
I froze, expecting Miss Johnson to beat Ann even worse than she had beat me. But instead, she just turned around and walked back into the building. "You girls get in your room and stay there until supper time," she roared over her shoulder.
"I'm sorry," I said to Ann. "You just wanted to help," Ann said, as we took each other's hand and walked back to our room.
Rest period was from 1 p.m. until 3 p.m. on Saturday and Sundays. We knew it was not because we needed to sleep, but because Miss Johnson wanted to rest. After her rest period was over, she had all the girls line up with the older girls leading everybody to the store at the gym. She told Ann and me that we could come out of our rooms. We watched them leave and went to sit down in the big cane-bottom rockers on the porch. We were both surprised when Mrs. Johnson came out, handed each of us a Coke and a bag of chips. She did not say a word, but simply turned around and walked back into the building.
Chapter 12. Christmas. The Christmas spirit decorated the hearts of all the students of the North Carolina School for the Blind in Raleigh. The teacher's parlor in Kay Cottage now held a big Christmas tree, as did parlors of all buildings on campus. For once in the year, we were allowed to go into the parlor and sing Christmas carols with ladies from churches in town who would come over and spend time with us. The auditorium in the school building became transformed into a storybook-like room with garland and tinsel and large branches of pine and cedar from the big trees outside. The auditorium was made up of about 300 seats lined in a row with a path down the center and along the sides like a church. In front of the auditorium was a stage which at Christmas also turned into whatever a child's mystical imagination could create. The footlights became red and green, and garland and bows decorated the front. This year, there was going to be a special Christmas program. Bobby Churchill and his girlfriend, Nora Jones, were the stars of the program. However, as the practices progressed, the teachers and staff said they were wondering if it was not going to be the little 7-year-old in red pajamas everybody remembered. The program would last 1 hour. This year, it was about a family whose father had gone to war and was missing in action. The family had a little girl that worshipped her father and walked in her sleep, calling his name. At some point in the program, the father would surprise the family and return from the war with broken legs, and he would have to sit down in a large chair. The family would celebrate with songs and speeches which were written and sung by high school students. His little girl, named Evie, would run over and sit on her daddy's lap until the program ended. I was to be Evie. The teachers had added something to the program. In the middle of the scenes, as the curtain was closed and things were being adjusted on stage, I was to step out in front of the big, heavy red curtain and sing Away in a Manger. I would be wearing a pair of red pajamas. Sally also had a part in the celebration. She was singing with a group of children just outside the auditorium as people came in. Like Hazel, Sally was like a little mother. Now, just like Hazel, who had walked with me to voice lessons, Sally walked with me to play practice in Library Hall.
"I don't see why Ann can't sing with me," I said to Sally as we walked in the cold December wind to practice. "Ann sings better than me, and we sing better together."
"Because Miss Davis likes to hear you sing," Sally said.
"Do you know Bobby's girlfriend?" I asked Sally.
"Her name is Nora, and she lives in Fisher Cottage with Emmeline," Sally said.
"Does Bobby kiss her?"
"We are not allowed to kiss on campus," she said. "We would get in trouble if we kissed each other."
"Why don't you give him a big kiss for Nora tomorrow when you go to sit on his lap? Won't I get in trouble?"
Sally must have thought about how it was when she was 7 years old. As she said, nobody could have talked her into singing on stage at that age. She did not realize that the fear of doing it was stronger than the fear of not doing it at all. Miss Davis would be mad if I wouldn't sing. So I held Sally's hand and felt courage from its warmth and strength as she led me up the 7 steps to Limebury Hall and into the very large entranceway. We passed the principal's office on the right, kept going straight, and walked up the big ramp that went into another large area where there were showcases with campus memorabilia. Past this room was the large auditorium, and we heard the noises of today's final practice getting underway. All the older students welcomed me as we got to the stage. "This is Nora," Sally said as a tall girl picked me up and hugged me.
"I like your boyfriend, but don't tell him," I said to Nora. "I like him, too," she said. "He can be your boyfriend, too, but we won't tell him, okay?"
I felt welcome and secure until Miss Davis came over. "Myra," she said, "you are going to remember to sing the song the way we practiced, aren't you?"
"Yes, ma'am,"
I lied, because I did not intend on singing the song like we had practiced. I just couldn't, and I couldn't tell Miss Davis why. But today I had a plan to make everybody understand and let me sing the song the way I wanted to.
"Mrs. Daniels," Bobby Churchill was saying,
"now, I have been off in the war for 3 years, and everybody thought this Christmas I was dead. Here I come in, yelling Merry Christmas at the top of my lungs, and my grieving wife comes running over here and gives me a silly little hug. Don't you think if a man has been gone for 3 years, he deserved more than a tiny little embrace? He might seem to need more, and he might want more, but he's not going to get more," Miss Daniels said. "Nice try," Miss Davis said to Bobby, as she made her way across the stage to the piano. It was dress rehearsal. Everybody knew their way around the stage. 3 times in the first scene, I wandered into the center stage, turning around several times and saying, "Daddy, where's my daddy?" Finally, John Roberts, Bobby's pretend brother, would pick me up and would sit me on his lap until the scene ended. Then I would make my way to the curtain and step out in front of it. Everything was dark except the spotlight that would shine on my red pajamas as I stood there.
"Away in a manger, no crib for a bed,"
I began and went right through the first verse. Then here it came, that second verse. I didn't want to sing, but I began.
"The cattle are lowing, the poor baby wakes."
Miss Davis stopped playing the piano and hit her fist on the keyboard. "Myra," she shouted, "I thought you were going to sing The Baby Awakes." I had practiced my speech this time and was ready.
"Well, I have to sing Poor Baby because Jesus was poor," I said.
"And just how would you know Jesus was poor?" Miss Davis asked.
"Because last summer, Papa came in and told Mama that the corn looked as poor as Jesus."
Everybody on and off stage burst into laughter. I didn't know why and thought they were laughing at me. I stood there with the tears in my eyes. I was trying not to cry. Anne had taught me a secret about crying. She told me you could pinch your finger hard enough. It will hurt bad and make the tears go away.
I pinched my finger really hard.
I didn't know how to explain to Miss Davis that Larry had taught me this song right out of the Baptist hymnal. I wanted Larry to know I sang the song just like he taught me so he wouldn't be mad with me over the Christmas holidays. He had already put my sawhorse Scout in the barn. There was no way Miss Davis was going to understand. Miss Davis and Mrs. Daniels were talking about cutting the song all together, or at least singing the first verse twice. I heard them.
"I know the third verse," I said.
"You do?" Miss Davis asked. "Let me hear you sing it." I began.
"Be near me, Lord Jesus, I ask thee to stay."
The song was saved and the final rehearsal was over. Tonight there would be a party for the entire student body in the gymnasium. A local radio personality, Mr. Fred Fletcher, would come and read some stories to everybody. There would be some singing, and students from each class had drawn names and would exchange their gifts. Santa Claus would come at the end. Everybody looked forward to this party, crowning the Christmas season on campus before going home after the program tomorrow. Thursday soon came, and there seemed to be a special smell in the air that morning. To me, it smelled a little like a church at home, but better. Everybody was dressed up, and the teachers made a swishing sound as they walked around with their hose rubbing together. Some teachers gave their students candy or cookies, and everybody who was under the age of 20 wanted to squirm in their seats trying to figure out what everybody else was so excited about. Backstage, Sally helped me into my pajamas.
"I don't like people to see me in my pajamas," I said.
"It's a fine time to decide that," Sally said, in a tone that I couldn't understand came from her own nervousness.
"Do you think people are going to laugh at me?"
I asked. "Nobody is going to laugh at you," she said. "Look, here's a piece of peppermint candy. Do you like peppermint?"
"Yes, ma'am," I said.
"You don't have to say yes, ma'am," to me, she said.
"Okay, ma'am," I said.
"Here, Myra, now don't you dare chew up this candy on stage or make noise with it, and don't you dare have it in your mouth when you sing, okay now?"
"Yes, ma'am, I mean Sally," I said, stuffing the peppermint into my mouth and biting it right away.
Sally stood me in my spot outside what they called stage left and kissed my head. "Now eat that candy, and don't you move until it's time for you to come out. Are you going to be all right?"
"I wish Ann was here," I said.
But then noises on the outside of the curtain began to dwindle, and everybody heard the principal, Mr. Stow, welcoming the parents, faculty, and students. Then he began making his own speech while everybody backstage, except me, giggled, straightened hair, and wiped their faces just one more time. Finally, the program began. It seems stranger doing the program with real people out there, even though I couldn't see anybody. I tried to listen for a call from Daddy, Mama, Larry, or even Ann. Finally, I decided to pay attention before I forgot what I was supposed to do, and everybody really would laugh at me. Once in front of the heavy red curtain, I pretended I was standing on top of my own scout horse in Lexington, singing to the dogs and cats the way I had done in Lexington. Thank goodness I remembered in time to skip the second verse and sing the verse Miss Davis had agreed on. Then, before I knew it, the program was over. Bobby Churchill swung me high in the air, and then I really did give him a big kiss.
"That was for Nora," I said and kissed him again, "and that was for me."
John Roberts hugged me, too.
"You make a pretty good lap, Daddy," I said.
People were clapping and chairs were springing back as people walked out of the auditorium. Hugs from all around covered me, and hands helped me quickly into my new Christmas dress and my winter coat. But the people all seemed to disappear quickly after walking back toward Kay Cottage.
Where were Larry and Daddy and Mama?
It was after lunch when Mrs. Johnson found me sitting alone in the big green rocking chair on the front porch, bundled up in my winter coat and crying. "Myra, what's wrong?" Mrs. Johnson asked as she pulled me out of the chair and sat down in it. Then she pulled me onto her lap. Most of the times I liked it when she did this, but I just couldn't put my arms around her and snuggle up to her large bosom like I really wanted to.
"Where's my daddy?"
I asked, just the way I did in the Christmas play. Even as I said it, the program and the excitement got all tangled up in my mind until I began to wonder if my own daddy had gone to war. "Oh, you know he'll be here," Mrs. Johnson said. "Why, he might have run into a lot of people going home for Christmas, or he might have got caught for speeding in that shiny red car." "Why, Myra, just a little while ago, you stood up there and sang like a little angel in front of all those people. Everybody wanted to be you today. You should be a very happy little girl."
Was she actually saying something nice about me?
I wondered. Just then, I heard a car door slam at the street and heard Daddy's allergic cough as he walked across the grass to the sidewalk.
"Where's everybody?" Daddy asked.
"Did you forget they got out at 12 today?" Mrs. Johnson said. "You missed hearing your little girl sing. I guess maybe that's a good thing, though, because we certainly don't want her to get a big head now, do we?"
"Oh, was that today?"
Daddy said. "I couldn't get off anyway until almost dinner time, and Geneva's working now." I didn't care a bit about big heads or Mama working now. All I knew was that my daddy was here and I was going home for Christmas. After Christmas, when I got back to school, I was shocked finding out that Sally and Laverne had been moved up to Cook Cottage as two girls had left Cook and there was room for them now. This happened often, as sometimes students would be able to go to public school or families would move away. Both girls were very excited about leaving Kay, but I felt lonely for them even before they gathered all their things and were gone. Chapter 13, The Green Dress. My mom will never forget the story of the green dress. Every fall, she would take me to town and buy all the clothes that were on the list that I would need for the entire year. At school, there was a room that served as a large clothes closet where all our dresses hung, little open lockers for our socks and underclothes, and another for shoes. Mrs. Johnson picked out our clothes every night. She picked out the same clothes, and often I grew out of clothes I had never gotten to wear, and she gave them to someone else. I remember wanting to dress up because the next day was what we called the sixth weekend when we would go home. I asked Mrs. Johnson to please let me dress up, but she would not. She pulled out the dress she knew I didn't like. It was a light green dress with a big white collar. There was nothing wrong with it except I worried about dropping something on that big white collar. I took the dress to my room, and my beaver teeth began making their way through one of the buttonholes. The threads kept getting hung up in my teeth, but I just stopped, spit them out, and start again. They surely were thick buttonholes, but finally I had one so completely open it would never hold a button again. Then I went to Miss Johnson's room. "The laundry must have torn up my buttonhole," I said. She took the dress and looked at it and started laughing.
"I guess they did," she said, "and guess what? It's still wet, too."
She thought it was really funny, but I remember feeling humiliated as I took my pretty pink dotted Swiss dress from the hanger. It wasn't as much fun to dress up as I thought it would be. No matter how long I lived in K, I never managed not to cry when Mama and Daddy left me on the steps those Sundays after a weekend at home. Every time they left, I tried harder and harder not to cry, but until Ann got back to school, it seemed impossible. This Sunday, I had just about made it, pushing my finger into my palm until I am sure it must have been ready to bleed.
"Did she tell you about biting a hole in her dress?" Miss Johnson asked. The tears came in buckets.
"Do you realize we almost got away without her crying?" my daddy said. "I don't care if she eats the whole dress if she wants to. All she wanted to do was look pretty for her mama and me."
"I believe she's a bit spoiled," Miss Johnson said.
Daddy snatched me up in his arms. "We're going over to Pullen Park," he said, "and she is going to have a large cone of ice cream for supper." I don't remember coming back to school that evening, nor whether or not I ever got to pick out my own clothes again. I do remember the one time I was able to choose my own outfit. I decided to wear my white dress with the red ribbon bow for the Easter program. Most children are in the fourth grade at age 9. But a year of kindergarten at age 6 put most of us behind. Billy and I were 9 and in the third grade when we were going to sing together in the Easter program. "Can I wear ribbons in my hair?" I asked Miss Johnson.
"No, you are supposed to wear your Easter bonnet. You can't sing about wearing an Easter bonnet and then not have one, can you? Besides, the hat has a red ribbon to match that one around your waist."
Billy and I were going to sing In Your Easter Bonnet while we would promenade around the stage holding hands and arms like professional dancers.
"Myra, that's a really pretty hat," Miss Davis said.
"Thank you, but you know I'd rather sing Peter Cottontail," I said.
"Well, this time you're going to dress up. Now you wouldn't like wearing a hot furry bunny outfit."
"No, but then nobody would have to kiss me. Billy doesn't mind kissing her. Now do you, Billy?"
"Yes, ma'am," Billy said. "I'd rather kiss a bunny."
Just then, Bobby Churchill came up to the stage. "Well, I hadn't," he said as he picked me up and swung me around, catching me high in his arms and kissed my cheek.
"You kiss her then," Billy said.
"You don't have to kiss me, Billy," I said. "I don't even want you to. Can Bobby kiss me instead, Miss Davis?" Miss Davis took Billy and my shoulders. "We have exactly 15 minutes until this program starts," she said. "You two will walk around the stage. Myra, you will not sing Peter Cottontail, and Billy, you will kiss her cheek. Is that clear?" How sweet and innocent 2 9-year-olds must have looked to an audience of 300. Billy's voice didn't shake at all as he hugged me, and my baby voice followed his, harmonizing some on the chorus. I even forgot to stick out my tongue when he kissed me like I had planned. Instead, I kissed him back. Miss Davis hugged us both backstage, and I felt her wet cheeks. Then the fourth and fifth graders came on stage to sing Peter Cottontail. Chapter 14, Learning. In third grade, we all learned to type. It was good to write Mama and Daddy letters and say things that we wanted to. Up until then, Mrs. Johnson had written all our parents a postcard that always said, "Dear Mother and Father, I am doing fine. Please send me some money." Ann and I took violin lessons together. We didn't especially love the violin, but we enjoyed getting to go somewhere besides the classroom for a little while. We also took piano, but not together. Miss Collins was a wonderful young piano teacher who was always trying to teach me to like classical music. I wanted to play Dale Wood's version of Down Yonder, but Miss Collins told me that I could play that only when I was in the practice rooms. One day, Miss Davis came into the piano studio. "Don't you think she is taking too many music classes?" Miss Davis asked Miss Collins. "No, not really," Miss Collins answered. "She seems to like piano, and I think she'll do quite well." "Well, I guess we can give it a try," Miss Davis said, but voice was her first music, so if anything has to go, it is not to be voice, and I think Mr. Greaves feels the same way about violin. "I like the piano," I said. "I want to play as good as Miss Collins." "I want you to play as good as I do," Miss Davis said. "I'm going to play as good as Dale Woods," I said. "She can play better than everybody." "Let's go back to our lesson," Miss Collins said. "Maybe she needs to take language instead of piano," Miss Davis said. I felt something cold between the two women, and there was no place to run. Miss Davis closed the door hard as she left, and I heard a sigh come from Miss Collins' piano bench. "Did I do something wrong?" I asked. "Not at all," Miss Collins said. "You are going to stay and learn piano until you can play better than Dale would if you want to." Chapter 15, Goodbye to Kay Cottage. Finally, the years had slipped away, and soon Ann and I were going to be sent up to Cook Cottage, which was the next level. I looked forward to seeing Laverne and Sally and some of the older girls again, but I was afraid Ann and I would not be able to room together all the time and cook like we had been in Kay. So we spent almost every minute together those last months making up new games to play. We slid down the slide together, hid in the same hiding place when we played games, and just took walks in the big yard. The bricks that held this building together were red, and Mrs. Johnson used small red blocks to make a border around the buildings of a large replica of the campus on a big square board. She glued Cracker Jack prizes all over the board and somehow managed to find places for many of the prizes that we gave her. In spite of the spankings we all got, or how much she seemed to yell, we loved her. Mama always talked about my dresses being sewed up with white thread, even if they were dark blue dresses. Mrs. Johnson said she did not have time to rethread her bobbin every time somebody tore something. Yes, as the days quickly passed, there was more love than anything else for this person who had been the only mother we knew once we had been dropped off at the school. We all loved doing things to please her, and she must have enjoyed us as she laughed a lot. However, on Wednesday, Ann and I were playing with each other's toes, naming them and pretending they were real people. It seemed very innocent to us, just a silly game because all of our toys were packed in the suitcases for the trip home on Thursday. Still, on Wednesday evening, Mrs. Johnson took us out and spanked us with a switch for playing with each other's toes. She made us sit on the bench in the hallway, missing our sweet sandwiches. "This will make you not miss K Cottage next year," she told us. We had not planned on missing K Cottage, but rooming with each other. I sat there thinking about all the wrong things I remembered, like the time Laverne and I stole Hattie Marshburn's candy. It had been another long Saturday with no trip to the store, and Hattie had left a large box of Hershey bars in her drawer. She had showed them to me before she left because she knew how much I loved the chocolate candy. Since she had gone for the weekend, and Mrs. Johnson did not let us go to the store that day, I showed Laverne the candy. I figured Hattie would not mind us having a bar. I gave Laverne a bar, and we did eat. However, Laverne and I both found that the candy had a very bitter aftertaste. For days, neither of us could eat. Finally, Laverne went to Hattie and told her. I was surprised when I went to Hattie myself to confess, only to find out that Laverne had already told her. We figured Hattie would surely understand and forgive us, but she went to Mrs. Johnson and told her what we had done. I thought about how Laverne was playing, and Mrs. Johnson had come, took me by the hand, and set me on her lap. It was the very last time I ever sat on her lap. "Stop that crying!" But my bottom lip trembled anyway. "I can't talk to you if you're going to cry," she said. "I'm trying to stop, but the tears just keep on coming." Finally, Mrs. Johnson told me about how my daddy left money for me every time he and Mama brought me back from home, and about how it was more money than I needed to spend at the store. I had been sharing my money, she said, with the other little girls who did not have any, so they could go to the store too and get things like shampoo and soap. For a year, I remember what Mrs. Johnson had told me as I sat on the bench that night, not crying. I realized that Mama and Daddy left me a lot of money every time I came back from home, and I realized that Mrs. Johnson was trying to tell me she used my money, too, for cigarettes and maybe even for the popcorn and drinks on Saturday nights. I was too young to know what to do with that kind of knowledge. But she was right. I would not miss K Cottage next year. Poem, I Remember K. Leaves from the oak trees that were as large as my face. The house mother telling us to look for and pick up paper from the school grounds when most of us could not even see the ground. Radiator pipes clanging early in the morning as though the steam heat was trying to get in or out. Pullen Park when it first got a train. The smell of ether. Feel of a ruler across my bare bottom. Being overjoyed to receive snail mail. Large Christmas trees with bubble lights, going to school on Thanksgiving Day, acorns, halo shampoo, learning Braille, dolls with heads as hard as mine, cane bottom rockers, the luggage room reeks of mothballs, city water, Brogans, every 6th Friday, afternoon naps, meeting Ronnie Millsap.
You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This ends Disc 2.